Bill Clinton's 8 years as president end tomorrow, and he'll leave office without a Middle East peace agreement. Last summer, President Clinton hosted a summit at Camp David between Israel's Prime Minister Ehud Barak and Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat, but the summit produced no breakthrough, and prospects for a deal in the near future appear dim. In the last installment of a week-long series on the Clinton foreign policy legacy, NPR's Tom Jaldum reports on the administration's Middle East record.
8 months after becoming president, Bill Clinton stood between Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat and Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin on the White House lawn. Though they had long been enemies, President Clinton got the two men to talk peace and even to shake hands.
What these leaders have done now must be done by others. Their achievement must be a catalyst for progress in all aspects of the peace process. And those of us who support them must be there to help in all aspects. For the peace must render the people who make it more secure. A peace of the brave is within our reach.
That previously unthinkable handshake in 1993 launched a negotiating process to produce a final agreement based on the so-called Oslo Accords. But in the end, the peace of the brave remained beyond the party's reach, despite U.S. mediation efforts continuing down to Bill Clinton's final hours in office.
It's almost like a pitcher who pitches strong 8 innings, but when he gets into the 9th inning, he can't close the deal.
David Makovsky of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy points out that Bill Clinton several times got close to a peace breakthrough at a summit with Syrian President Hafez al-Assad last spring, at Camp David last summer, and as recently as last month when he almost got Yasser Arafat and Ehud Barak to meet once more in Egypt. But it was never enough.
For all the dedication, the goodwill, the intensive thinking about these issues, they haven't been able to close the deal on different fronts, whether it's the Syrian front, Palestinian front, or terrorism. And this, I think, is also part of the legacy.
At this point, after 7 years of talking, the Israelis and Palestinians in some ways are further from a peace deal than they were when the process began. The negotiating framework agreed at Oslo no longer applies. And yet, Adi Dawisha of Miami University says it's hard to imagine the two sides not meeting anymore.
It's become normal to see Palestinians and Israelis talk to each other across the table, to see them joke with each other, even to eat with each other. And that you can see reflected in the Arab world itself, in the media, in the newspapers, and in the television. It's no longer strange that this is happening. I mean, even those who are against the idea are now resigned to it. And I think that kind of breakdown of the psychological barrier is something that the Clinton administration should be proud of.
The question is whether this now routine contact between the parties has prepared them for the next step, making the required political concessions. The danger is that with the violence of the past few months, the two sides no longer have enough confidence, either in each other or in the process itself, to make peace. Israelis and Palestinians for the past several years believed peace could actually be achieved, says David Makovsky, and it was this expectation that kept the negotiation going.
What needs to be restored is this sense that the conflict will end, and in the land for peace equation, that the Palestinians will get the land and Israel will get the peace and people can move on with their lives. And it's that sense of hope that's really been one of the greatest casualties.
President Clinton this past summer publicly blamed the Palestinian side for not matching concessions made by the Israelis during the push for an agreement. But from the Palestinian perspective, the peace process broke down because the Clinton administration tilted too far toward the Israelis. Rashid Khalidi of the University of Chicago says the Clinton administration and its Middle East envoy, Dennis Ross, squandered a peacemaking opportunity by not getting the Israelis to stop building settlements in the occupied territories.
In a situation where the two parties are making peace, the fact that 80,000 more settlers have been established in 7 years is a damning indictment of the people who never raised a squawk about it, nor Dennis Ross, nor the Secretary of State, nor the President's National Security Advisor ever got up and said, "You are not serious about making peace if these kinds of things are happening." And unfortunately, that was the reality of the 7 years. The agreements are almost as nothing today, but the settlements are solid as rock. and the political realities that were created in these 7 years inside Israel and in response to that among the Palestinians are going to be very, very hard to overcome.
Administration officials bristle at the suggestion they haven't been even-handed in the management of the Israeli-Palestinian negotiations. In an interview, National Security Advisor Sandy Berger said the peace proposals put forward by President Clinton last month are by far the most favorable ever offered to the Palestinians. Israeli and Palestinian leaders are preparing to make one final push for a peace settlement before next month's Israeli elections, and incoming Secretary of State Colin Powell said this week the Bush administration will do its best to move the peace process forward. But the new administration is widely expected to shift its focus away from the Israeli-Palestinian conflict narrowly and toward the region as a whole. Such a shift could make up for what some analysts see as a flaw in the Clinton administration's approach to the Arab world. Robert Pelletreau is a former Assistant Secretary of State for Near East Affairs.
Over the past few months, there's been a tendency on the part of the United States to treat its relations with Arab countries solely through the prism of the Middle East peace process. And obviously, many of these countries have much more complex and diversified relations with the United States that should be recalibrated.
The cooling of U.S. relations with Arab countries is especially clear with respect to Iraq, where Saddam Hussein is still in power 10 years after the end of the Gulf War. Adid Dawishaw of Miami University says President Clinton and his advisors for the past several years have left the Iraqi situation to fester.
The Iraqi regime under Saddam Hussein is now stronger than it was in the middle of 1990, certainly stronger than it was when Clinton took over. Saddam's international airport is now open. Planes are landing and taking off on a regular basis. The sanctions have been busted on the Turkish border. All of the Arab countries are now talking to the Iraqis and treating them as though they were normal partners, as they were before the Gulf War.
Clinton administration officials do not hide their disappointment that Saddam Hussein remains as powerful as he is. National Security Advisor Sandy Berger acknowledges there has been erosion of the sanctions, but he insists the basic program is intact. Iraq is still restricted in the use of its revenue from the sale of oil.
After 10 years, it's hard to maintain a sanctions regime, particularly the countries in the region begin to get a little bit harder to convince to stay with it. But I think as long as we stay focused on the core purpose here, which is money for food, not money for tanks, I think we can sustain the sanctions.
The other big Middle East concern, of course, is Iran. The election of a moderate president, Mohammad Khatami, in 1997 set the stage for better U.S.-Iranian relations. 1 year later, President Clinton said the time had come for reconciliation with Iran and the United States lifted some minor sanctions. But generally, the efforts at rapprochement have not gone far, and Iran's importance has grown more obvious. Its oil reserves make it a key power in the region. Russia is proposing a new partnership, and the concern over the nuclear arms race between India and Pakistan underscores Iran's strategic location. The old goal of trying to contain Iran rather than engage it will almost certainly be reconsidered in the coming months. One more example of the foreign policy shifts likely to come when the government here changes hands. Tom Gelton, NPR News, Washington.